The windows and doors were open so that not only my hands but my body and feet were cold, and my head also began to ache. At last, to cut matters short, I played her miserable piano. What annoyed me most of all was that the Duchess and the gentleman never stopped drawing for a moment, but coolly continued what they were doing, so that I had to play to an audience of chairs and tables and walls. Finally, I got up and said I'd be glad to come back when some better instrument could be found, but the Duchess persuaded me to wait until her husband came in. He sat down beside me and listened with great attention, and I forgot all about the cold and the headache, and in spite of the miserable piano, played as I can play when I'm in the right mood. In that letter to his father from May 1, 1778, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart gives an idea of how unpredictable keyboards could be in the late 18th century. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
As the harpsichord, the pianoforte, and the fortepiano competed to be the keyboard instrument of the future, what was the effect on the way music was written, on the way it was played, and for that matter, on the way audiences listened to it? Our guest with the answers is Eva Badura-Skoda, author of the upcoming book, The History of the Fortepiano, from Domenico Scarlatti to Chopin, and co-author with Paul Badura-Skoda of Mozart Interpretation, which is due out this summer.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you brought with you, too, part of your film that you worked on for public television in Austria, The History of the Pianoforte. And that brings me to ask you about the difference between forte piano, pianoforte. Those terms seem to be used interchangeably, but
yes, that's true. In the north of Germany, in the north part, in middle Germany, they used pianoforte. And in the south, they used more often fortepiano. And recently, when the fortepiano was rediscovered for the concert hall, my colleagues decided to make the difference between a modern piano and an old piano in calling the old Mozart piano fortepiano. So that's the reason why we speak today often of fortepiano for old instruments.
Well, it didn't sound, this fortepiano, quite like a harpsichord and yet not quite like a piano that we're used to today either. Somewhere in between, what was the difference?
Yeah, at the very beginning, the fortepiano was a very delicate instrument made from wood only. And that was also the reason why some of them went out of order and out of tune very soon. And Mozart sometimes had to complain about bad instruments, as you just mentioned before. And Mozart himself was very fond of fortepianos and less fond of clavichords, because the clavichords were good only in the way they were built in North Germany, but not in South Germany.
That big a difference?
There was a big difference, because especially Vienna was more Italian dominated, and the Italians were not fond of clavichords as performing instruments. They had only clavichords for travel and practice and composing, but they were small, cheap instruments and not the very beautiful, large ones which were used in the north.
The Italians preferred stringed instruments.
But they needed keyboard instruments also to accompany singers and to compose.
Well, if we look at the name, you know, which really just means loud, soft, or soft, loud, whichever way, was it then a deliberate attempt to invent or to create an instrument with the dynamic range? I mean,
yes. This was already tried in the 16th century. We know of strumento piano et forte, which were used in Ferrara, but we have no instrument preserved from that time. But during the 17th century, there were several attempts to make a fortepiano. And actually, the attempt was to have a mechanic, an action working for the harpsichord, for the cembalo, which would make the dynamic shading. And it was Cristofori who was the one who really succeeded in inventing a very, very good mechanic which worked.
This is 1720?
No, it was at the end of the 17th century.
That early.
In the year 1700, we have already a description of the gravicembalo che fa il piano e il forte, which means the cembalo which can make a piano and a forte. And this actually gave finally German the idea to call the instrument pianoforte, which the Italians didn't like, because for them, pianoforte, these were adjectives. And to make,
to make a noun
yeah. out of it, you wouldn't like an instrument called soft, loud, or loud.
It does sound funny.
It's a little prosaic, but yes. I guess it was a marketing tool even then.
But, you know, the interesting thing is whenever Mozart or Beethoven used the Italian language for their music, they wrote cembalo. And the cembalo meant for them a cembalo con martelli, with a cembalo with hammer, a hammer harpsichord.
And does the term cembalo have any particular meaning?
The cembalo, the term cembalo in the 18th century actually was used for every wing-shaped instrument or harp-shaped, lying harp-shaped instrument. And it doesn't say whether it was a hammer harpsichord or a harpsichord with quills. And this was really my discovery 20 years ago, which now, by now, I think is accepted by my colleagues.
And this first inventor, this Cristofori, what do we know about him? Anything that makes...
That he was a very proud and very gifted man working in... Also, he was also a musician. He played himself. But he was working as a cimbalayo in Padua. And at that time, of course, you had to make your living as an instrument maker. But he still refused for at the very beginning to work for the Medici Ferdinando, Principe Ferdinando, the crown prince, and was finally persuaded to move in 1688 to Florence. And there he could work on his invention. And in 1700, we know for sure that he had succeeded.
And these instruments were still intended for fairly small audiences, small intimate settings.
No. I think he intended it the whole world to have them. But,
but
they were
much too expensive. I mean, in terms of the number of people in the audience who could actually hear it, though. I mean, it's not like a concert piano by any means.
Oh, you will be surprised. The instrument, which is the oldest extant instrument, which is preserved at the Metropolitan Museum now, is from 1720, a Cristofori instrument, and it is as loud as the Mozart instrument.
Really?
It is fantastically loud. My husband, Paul Badura-Skoda, played it in a concert for the 100th anniversary of the instrument collection of the Metropolitan Museum. And I was sitting in the Grace Hall, which holds about 500 people, very much in the back. And I could hear it very well. And if you want to hear too, I have an example here. What you heard is Scarlatti Sonata, and this was chosen by purpose because Scarlatti was the first great pianist, one could say. He also played, of course, the harpsichord. But when he was employed in Portugal, in Lisbon, he took apparently an instrument with him from Cristofori. And finally, the Queen of Spain, who employed him then in Madrid, and who had been his pupil already in Lisbon, had five instruments from Florence, five pianos. Two of them were later made to harpsichords again because the action is so complicated and so difficult that apparently it was ruined.
They were converted back into the earlier kind of instrument.
Yes, but one instrument is a very interesting instrument. It became a compound. It was a compound instrument, but that's another story.
Wow.
In the instrument that we just heard, the one from 1720, yeah. When you listen to it, what about that sound appeals to you in a way that, say, a modern piano would not? What do you hear that you like?
I think what I really love with this instrument is the clearness, the beauty of the tone, and the fact that you can make every fine notes, which you could do on the violin only or in the voice.
So but not on the harpsichord.
Not on a harpsichord. And I think that was really very much appropriate for the music which was then written at the beginning of the 18th century.
And we hear that kind of dynamic range then in, I mean, Scarlatti is an unusual case, isn't he, as an Italian composer who wrote hundreds of little keyboard sonatas.
560 sonatas. Yeah, I think he had at his disposal not only fortepianos, but also harpsichords, very beautiful harpsichords. Also Spanish instrument makers copied the Cristofori very soon. Mirabel is one of those makers. And I think that he chose for some sonatas the harpsichord, and for others, the pianoforte.
That's a fascinating thing. And, of course, you hear them recorded on either instrument without knowing necessarily what his intention was.
It's difficult to... The harpsichordists, of course, think everything should be played on the harpsichord.
Yes, I've heard that.
With the Cristofori piano forte or forte piano, what was lacking? What would you say its limitations were as an instrument?
There was a limitation, a very serious one, because that was an invention then later in Germany by Silbermann. The harpsichord had dampers. And also the cembalo che fa il piano e il forte had dampers, but you couldn't lift them. That means what is today called a paddle to lift the dampers in a modern piano wasn't invented by Cristofori. So my husband chose by purpose a piece where he needed no paddle, actually.
What do you mean that you couldn't lift it? In other words, if you put down the damper, it would stay down? Or I don't understand.
The dampers would stay down. That was no intermingling of sound. But think of, let's say, Chopin. You need constantly the possibility to lift dampers so that if you have special passages where you would like to have the intermingling of sound, you can have them with no dampers.
And you do that just by taking your foot off?
No,
in the later
you
piano,
put your foot down.
Okay.
Yeah, but you are right. You have really a good idea for me to mention that in the 18th century, it was sometimes in Germany the other way around. You had always intermingling, and you even had instruments with no dampers at all. And if you put your foot down, then you had dampers on. By now, this is vice versa. Mm-hmm. If you put your foot down and use the pedal, the right pedal on modern instruments, then you have the intermingling of sounds.
You can see why Mozart would have gotten frustrated by some of those instruments.
And what else would Cristofori, if he sat down to play on his own piano, what other composers might he have played?
I think Scarlatti would have been one, because the young Scarlatti was known as a very good keyboard player and came with his, as a 17-year-old boy, one could say, but already organist from Napoli with his father in 1702, 2 years after the description of the first fortepiano, to Florence. And I'm very sure that Ferdinando was so proud to show him now the new instrument, and Cristofori also was proud of it, I'm sure. So he would be the appropriate first composer to use this instrument.
Did later builders work from Cristofori's design, or did they strike out on their own?
Very good to ask this. There were two attempts to use different ways. One was already by Gottfried Silbermann, who invented an instrument which he called cembal d'amour. But it was actually, the Germans started more from the clavichord to invent an instrument which could have dynamic shadings. And that was the first attempt which he made. And then he came across a Cristofori instrument, and that was it. He copied it completely, and then that was a success. Because these instruments were so good that King Frederick, which the Germans call Frederick the Great, tried to get as many as he could, and it is said that he had 15 Silbermann pianofortes.
More on the history of the piano when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Farley's House of Pianos in Madison, presenting musicologist Ava Badura-Skoda, lecturing on the history of the pianoforte, Monday, February 26th at 7:30. Tickets at farleyspianos.com or 271-2626.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Ava Badura-Skoda, who is telling us about the history of the fortepiano. Now, one thing that the harpsichord could do pretty well before the fortepiano came along, the harpsichord could imitate other instruments. Was that something that the fortepiano could do?
You mean that the harpsichord had stops like the organ?
Yes, yes.
Yes, there were quite a number of stops. Yeah, on harpsichords, mainly, of course, at the beginning, the lute stop, something which was called harp stop. And later in Germany, this was mainly a German matter, all the many stops for the harpsichord, were also used for the earliest pianos. And, of course, there are some wonderful examples, and later in Vienna, we had an instrument with 7 pedals because it had so many stops, different stops. You just heard a stop which is called Turkish music stop or Janissary music stop. This was invented probably near the year 1783, the 100th anniversary of the besiege of Vienna, when Turkish music was very much en vogue and in. And therefore, I think the instrument makers made this kind of stop. And I think the only piece of Mozart on the piano which could fit in is the one of the Turkish march of the sonata in A major, K331.
And what difference did Mozart make to the improvements on the piano, the development of the piano as an instrument? I mean, he wrote so much for it. Did he actually influence the instrument?
Yes, I think he did. Not as much as Beethoven and Liszt, but he certainly also influenced the makers to make the instrument more singing, more romantic in sound. So at the beginning, he was very fond of instruments by a maker named Spät and then of Stein from Augsburg. But when he came to Vienna and came across instruments by the instrument maker Anton Walter, he was very fond of it because Walter had the most modern sound, a kind of romantic velvet sound. And actually also Beethoven was very fond of Anton Walter instruments. And they were also the loudest instruments because Mozart needed a loud instrument for playing concerti with a whole orchestra or small orchestra. And the result of this was that he wanted also to enlarge the range of the instrument, and they became, especially in the bass, much larger through the fact that he asked Anton Walter to build him an additional instrument which he could play with his feet, because Mozart was a trained organist in the youth, and he was able to play very well on a pedal board. So we have some examples that he used those for fantasies, free fantasies, but also for his concerti, the tutti sections where he played with the feet and had his hands for conducting.
Do the Mozart piano concertos, the 27 concertos that he wrote over the course of a fair number of years, do they give us something of a history of the keyboard in themselves? I mean, he wrote the first ones when he was a child, and then he was quite a mature composer by the time he wrote the last.
I think the instrument was already really developed at the beginning, only they were so delicate that they didn't last long. And after 5 years or 10 years, he wanted a new one.
Now, you said that Beethoven had an even more profound influence on the instrument. How so?
Especially very soon, because Beethoven was a different kind of person than Mozart. Mozart was somehow always complying with what he had and using it very well, but not pounding on his instruments the same way Beethoven did. And Beethoven, of course, demanded a lot from the instrument makers.
Now, the one term that Beethoven seems to have a monopoly on is hammerklavier. There's this massive late hammerklavier sonata of his. What kind of instrument was that?
It's the same instrument, only Beethoven wanted to have all words not to be foreign words anymore.
Just
wanted
another marketing
them to be German. It was the first nationalism which broke out during the Napoleonic Wars. So that was the reason.
And he used, for a while at least, Beethoven used German tempo markings too, didn't
also,
he?
Also, yes. And so. But in the Opus 101, for instance, he writes in Italian, Tutto il cembalo. Since he had asked before, una corda, one string, it doesn't make sense with a cembalo in our sense. It only makes sense if you know that the cembalo could be a hammer harpsichord.
And are there competing instrument makers at this time trying? I mean, you talked about nationalism, so do you have German and Italian piano makers competing for what the instrument should sound like?
Yes, the Germans, of course, had the greatest number of instrument makers. There were around 1,800 or about 150 makers in Vienna, and in Berlin also about nearly 100. But they had small workshops, relatively small. These were not yet factories. While in London, as soon as some Germans there had introduced the pianos around 1760, there the makers became directors of factories, especially Broadwood. And then they supplied, I think, the whole world with their pianos. They were the commercialized makers of pianos, and the Broadwood was a very interesting, good instrument at that time.
And there's a reference to it in a Jane Austen novel. You know, there's a lot of references to pianos being used as decoration, as furniture.
Yes.
Which must have been...
Unfortunately, we came across when we were collecting instruments which were used as a bar. That's, of course, a pity, because if you take off the strings and well, yes. That for a musician is always something where he starts to cry.
Well, speaking of crying and emotions in general, with that greater dynamic range that the instrument is developing as we get into the late 18th century, it affects the way the music is written. Is that the sequence of events? You had a more versatile keyboard, and so you were able to express more emotion in the performing and composing?
Yeah, let's say the emotions were not expressed in the subtle way of Mozart anymore, but in the more foundering way of Beethoven.
So that keyboard, it's overstating it, but tell me where I'm overstating it. The improved keyboard, the more versatile keyboard, actually made Romanticism possible.
Yeah, the sound of the instruments in Beethoven's time had to become much stronger, built much more resistant to a pianist like him. And you can compare it in weight, for instance. A Mozart instrument has about 70 kilos. A Beethoven instrument has more than 100 already.
Oh. Mm.
So it is something which you can see the soundboard even, and especially the hammers. And the strings became also thicker, the hammers became larger, and of course that created more sound. They became louder.
It's
and
almost...
the range also became from 5 octaves to 6 octaves, a larger one.
It's almost as if those instruments, the instrument of Mozart, I'll say, and the instrument of Beethoven, are a direct reflection of the physique and the personality of the composers.
Yes. And actually all of them have their merits. To play on a Mozart instrument, as an Anton Walter, or Haydn preferred the Schanz, which were also excellent masterpieces, is something else than to play on a Konrad Graf. But all three instruments have their own merits.
And as we move to, let's say, Chopin,
yes.
How does the instrument change? Or is he using pretty much the same piano as Beethoven?
At the beginning, yes. When he was playing in Vienna, he used Konrad Graf's instrument, was taken by them because they had a beautiful sound, and was writing enthusiastic letters about Konrad Graf to his parents. But when he came to Paris, it's very interesting. He's met the pupil of Haydn, Pleyel. This actually, the father, Ignaz, was still alive when he came. No, he wasn't alive anymore when he came. The son, Camille Pleyel, was alive. And Camille was very fond of him. They became good friends. And he used the Pleyel instrument for also teaching his students, saying, you know, if you use an era, this is an instrument which sounds by itself. You don't have to produce a beautiful sound. It's always beautiful. But a Pleyel I prefer because there you have to make the sound beautiful.
Oh, it's more up to the composer or the performer to get that beautiful
sound.
Now, at
the end of his life, he had three instruments in London in his room, a Pleyel, an era, and a Broadwood. What you just heard now was a Broadwood piano from the middle of the 19th century, and I think it was the very best time of the Broadwood pianos. It sounded, for my opinion, beautifully. It was at that time, in the year 1853, when three companies was founded. Steinway in New York, Bechstein in Berlin, and Blüthner in Leipzig. And these three companies were really then producing the very best instruments in the second half of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century.
Muzio Clementi also built and marketed and demonstrated keyboards throughout Europe.
Yeah, now Muzio Clementi is a special case. He was the only rival for Mozart as a pianist. They both were the two great pianists in the 80s. Clementi had a heartbreaking experience. He wanted to marry the daughter of a merchant in Lyon and wasn't given the permission. Tried to
elope with her?
Yeah. And it was had a bad end, the story. He was caught. And then there is a really heartbreaking report how he cried for about a year and did hide in Switzerland. And then he decided to become wealthy, because the only thing to be acknowledged in society was not to be a traveling artist, that was nothing, but to be a merchant. And then he became a publisher and a producer of pianos. He had bought the company of Longman and Broderip. And the Clementi instruments were good instruments because he was taking care of everyone before it left the factory, and he knew how to play, that is clear. But he was not playing in public anymore.
He traveled with John Field, though, and used John Field to demonstrate his pianos?
Yeah, after 1810. He didn't pay.
He apparently got quite stingy, too, with his money, from what John Field
yes,
tells us.
Yes, and he died as a rich man.
What difference did the arrival of virtuoso pianists like Liszt or others, you know, the sort of virtuoso culture of show-off and, you know, fancy passages, did that put new demands on instrument makers? And
yes, certainly. Liszt was demanding a lot from the instruments, and there are the reports that he had sometimes three instruments on stage because one or the other one had broken strings, and he had to use a third one then. So he really took the utmost out of the instrument's capability.
Did they have to work to make the action faster so you could play more notes quickly?
Stronger sideboards, stronger strings. The action became also much more heavier.
At what point does the keyboard actually reach its current size? I mean, I know Bösendorfer has a little extra on the bass
extra,
end.
Yes, the Imperial had
extra. Imperial, yes. But at what point do we get our 88 keys?
I think after the second half of the century.
Of the 19th century?
Yeah.
That late?
Yes. 6.5 octaves was the utmost, which was known to Beethoven. And then 7 octaves, maybe, to Liszt.
What about Schubert, Franz Schubert? Who
also only 6.5.
What did he do, though, to bring more expressiveness to the instrument? If we think of Schubert's sonatas,
because he employed all 10 fingers so much that I couldn't play his sonatas.
So it was more...
No, but he was really writing like a symphonic style.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, we think of Beethoven in some ways as being kind of the limit of what you can do with a keyboard, but then Schubert comes along a little bit later and in some ways, maybe more subtle ways, does things beyond what Beethoven did in the sonata form.
What Beethoven did for the quartets, in his last string quartets, Schubert did in his last 3 sonatas.
You mean a little bit crazy?
No, I wouldn't call it crazy. It's only a new world. And it was, for instance, beyond the understanding of Schumann. He found that...
Who was actually a younger composer.
Yeah.
More on the history of the piano when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Farley's House of Pianos in Madison, presenting musicologist Eva Badura-Skoda, lecturing on the history of the pianoforte, Monday, February 26th at 7:30. Tickets at farleyspianos.com or 271-2626.
Please continue to enjoy the program this afternoon and call us at 1-800-383-9772 with a pledge of your financial support for Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Eva Badura-Skoda, and we're talking about the history of the forte piano. She will be presenting a lecture on that topic, the history of the pianoforte, at Farley's House of Pianos in Madison, Monday night, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. We have been talking about earlier instruments, but as we head into the 20th century, the name that I guess all of us probably think of as the leader of piano makers would be Steinway. Where does that sort of dominance or that name recognition start?
I think the dominance started after First World War, because Steinway had enough money to build a factory in Hamburg. They had already built the factory towards the end of the 19th century, but to make it a very great factory. And the other Europeans, the German companies, Blüthner and Bechstein, didn't have money at all, and the Germans didn't have money to buy instruments. So the leading artists, instrument makers, Blüthner and Bechstein suffered from this fact that the war was lost for Germany. And after that, I think Steinway really was, I think, the leading company all over the world. You have Steinways everywhere in a concert hall, so every artist has to know how to use a Steinway. However, we have still other companies which have excellent instruments, and some artists prefer them. Among them, Bösendorfer is from Austria, who is now leading in computer pianos.
And will you explain what that is, a computer piano?
Oh, it is an instrument which can record with more than 1,000 inputs for every second. It reports exactly the nuances of playing of an artist. So you cannot really distinguish whether the artist is playing or whether it's...
It's a player piano?
Yes, but it's much, much better than what had been invented in the old days.
What does it look? Does it look like a computer with a fancy keyboard? Then?
Or does it have a play from a disc or what?
No, it has a black box underneath the instrument, which has all the electronic equipment. I haven't seen the latest development of that, but I was told it is now different. You don't have the black box anymore, but it was all built into the instrument. And it is just simply fantastic for teaching, because every student can see and hear what he had done when playing a piece. Afterwards, he hears all the nuances which were done wrongly, or if he had taken too much pedal, if he had pressed one note too heavy. And it is, I think, something very special. You also, a person like Glenn Gould would have loved it, because he could record everything immediately from playing.
And that's true. And I gather that you see the pedals depress also?
Yeah. My husband played...
Great for Halloween in particular.
Yeah. He played a forehand with himself. He first played the two left hands, and then they played by themselves, and he had to play the two right hands afterwards with himself. But he always said it's much easier to have a companion whom you can just make a sign.
Is it bad? Is it bad if I have this sort of feeling? Maybe this is, I don't know, a lingering romanticism or something, but it sounds almost scary not to have a piano that simply is there.
But it plays by
itself. I don't know. In other words, does a computer piano have a soul? Does it have that sound of, you know, yes. There's something wonderful about an idiosyncratic instrument that has its own, I don't know.
Yes, but I think every large music school should have such an instrument. Yamaha made also some instruments of this kind, but they were half that sensitive and good. And I think Bösendorfer is now leading in this field.
Well, these, in a sense, they go way back even in concert use. I don't know how frequently computer pianos are used in concerts today, but there's a notable case of Sir Malcolm Sargent conducting Dame Myra Hess playing the Grieg Piano Concerto, and she wasn't there. It was, again, it was a device. This was in the 20s, and it was a device on which she had recorded the piano part of the concerto.
Yeah.
They had some malfunctions during the rehearsal where she wound up playing an entirely different movement, but that was an electric problem and not with the actual device.
Not electronically.
But Sir Malcolm actually performed this entire concert, and it was to promote the piano. I mean, it was bankrolled by this piano company, but apparently it worked quite well in concert.
Yeah. Now, it will take some time till this becomes worldwide known and used, but I'm sure it has some future. It's interesting what you can do in the future with the piano, because after all, pianos are those instruments where a single person, a single musician, can really do everything himself.
That's true. Think of the potential if you're double booked as a performer. You can say, well, I can't be there, but I'll send my
computer disc. Oh, I don't know.
No, I don't think so. You have to be there.
Now, I understand that as part of...
Excuse me, interrupting. You have to be there, but you can record at the same time. and have afterwards your CD out.
I have seen some of that lately.
Yes, my husband also has this. He played in Rio de Janeiro. It was one of the large ecology meetings some years ago, and he was the artist who played for all of the conference people there. And it was recorded on the computer piano of Bösendorfer.
You'd have to make a snap judgment, though, if you play a concert and then immediately you're making recordings available because you wouldn't have the leisure to listen to what it actually sounded like.
Yeah, right.
Now, I understand that as you were working on your History of the Pianoforte film for public television that you include on that interview with a Steinway, is that correct?
With Henry Steinway, yes. It was for me a great pleasure to meet him and see still the first tools which were brought over from Germany by the family. And he showed me all these things and also gave a short history of the development in the United States and how they became the leading company in piano making.
There was one notable New England manufacturer of pianos, and I'm not sure if they're still with us or not, but Hamlin and Mason?
Yeah, but they made more harmonium and organs than pianos. Now, there was a very good company before Steinway, Chickering.
Sure, yes, very well known in the 19th century.
Excellent instruments, and actually the Liszt Museum in Budapest had a Chickering exhibited which Liszt owned. But Liszt played all instruments. He was not like Chopin, who preferred first the Graf and then the
Erard
and Pleyel. But Liszt played for every company. And I still have seen a letter from Liszt in which he thanks Mr. Steinway.
Well, Liszt had one advantage that Chopin didn't, and that was he lived to be about 70 years old.
And had more success.
In the 1880s. Yeah.
We've talked mostly about the sound of these different instruments, but it's true they also have a visual appeal when you look at them. Pianos are often beautiful instruments as well, just to see. And if you think about all the different pianos that are featured, for example, in your film about the history of the pianoforte, are there ones that stand out just for sheer aesthetic appeal to the eye?
Yeah, I do think so.
Because somehow the computer piano with its black box, I'm having trouble picturing that in quite the same way.
Of course, yeah. Now, first of all, it's hard to compare a wooden instrument from the Mozart period, which weighs about 70 kilos, as I said, and then 700 kilos of a modern Steinway or a modern
700. Wow.
Yeah. You can't move it so easily in your home.
Although there are pianists even today. Horowitz had that reputation of always traveling with his piano.
With his own piano, yes. Which was extremely, I would say, light in sound. Very loud and light and easy to play comparatively.
But not just any pianist would have the wherewithal to have his piano come with him.
Yeah, it's not so easy to travel with a piano. It's easier with a flute or a violin.
But I gather that they are less temperamental in terms of the tuning and being moved than the early instruments.
Of course, the tuning is easier probably because they are... We have a Bösendorfer from the early 19th century which hasn't been tuned for years and is still in tune.
Really? Now, that I hadn't heard of.
Yeah, they keep in tune very well.
But what about the pressures of inventing instruments that are small and fit apartments?
To be honest, I'm not very fond of these instruments because I think it's on the expense of the sound beauty. If you have a pianino, a small upright, then I think the smaller it is, the less beautiful the sound is.
Is this true of uprights in general as opposed to grand pianos, do you think?
I think so, yes. There were very good uprights which Steinway built for a long time, but they are rather big and not very beautiful to look at, but they sounded much better than the smaller ones. And also Bösendorfer built very good uprights. But always a wing-shaped instrument is something which the artist will always prefer.
Now, what prompted Berzendorfer to add those extra notes down at the bottom? Was that performer demand, or was that just they thought they could find a niche and market it?
It was performer demand, too. I think it was very much liked by the Impressionists later on, I mean, also by Brahms. But especially Debussy, you can play much better, and Ravel. It's fantastic, these low sounds, which you sometimes, if you have this octave, for instance, in Gaspard de la Nuit.
The Ravel, yes.
In the Ravel, in the second piece, Le Gibet, then it is
a very atmospheric piece.
An enrichment in sound, which is...
Best on a Berzendorfer, you think?
I think, yeah.
And if you think about the future of the piano, 10 years from now, will it just be fancier computer pianos, do you think? Or do you see new directions for the piano?
I hope that the audience understands that the beauty of sound is really the most important thing. And people don't buy too many electronic keyboards because... they never can replace a real piano. And I do hope very much that the piano stays to be the most interesting and the most versatile musical instrument which we have.
When we get into all being said and done, how important is it, do you think, to get into a period instrument for a piano? In other words, if you're playing Chopin, really, how important is it to have a Chopin-era piano to bring out what the composer had in mind, or Beethoven, or Schubert?
Very important, in my opinion, and I think we were really the very first who found this out, to use a Mozart piano. Paul was the first artist who brought out records played on a Walter instrument in the museum in Vienna in 1956. And I still recall the director of Westminster Records who said, that's crazy, and nobody will buy this record. And it became a seller.
Well, we even had somebody here at Wisconsin Public Radio who said the first time he heard a recording of a forte piano and wasn't really expecting it, so there's something wrong with that.
Yeah. Yes, at the very beginning, people reacted very often so to say now the development of the piano is such a wonderful thing. It always became better and better and better, but it changed. By now, I think there are many people who know that Mozart piano has its advantage if you play Mozart, and a Beethoven piano has its advantage, a Konrad Graf, if you play Beethoven, and also with Chopin.
Now, what about
Brahms?
Brahms, or
yes.
Another B, Bach, who, of course, wrote for the harpsichord, not the piano
Disagree. Bach already for his last 16, 17 years wrote also for the forte piano, for the early Silbermann instruments.
And you can tell the difference in late Bach keyboard versus earlier?
I think Bach was certainly approving of the sound of the early pianos, because he might even have had himself an instrument, which was a double instrument, a compound instrument, a harpsichord piano.
How is it known that those later ones were written for a different instrument? Does it say that in his notations, or it's just sort of assumed?
Or is it doing things that a harpsichord can't do?
Bach once had opened a new series of concerts in 1733, when he said in his own words, "You will hear, there will be a concert in Zimmermann's garden at 3 o'clock next Wednesday, and you will hear now a cembalo which you have never heard before."
Mm.
And now cembalo, harpsichord, of course, was played very often. So a special kind of cembalo which you never have heard before at that time could be only what Silbermann at that time had presented to the king in Dresden a year earlier, the piano, called pianoforte.
And Bach would have written special music to show off what it could do.
Yes.
As so many other composers did with later instruments.
Yes, some Bach scholars think that all the concerti, which were written after this time, were written also for the pianos. Especially, I personally think, the Concerto for Three Chamberly, because at that time, it was in 1740, he ordered also a lute piano. And then he had a fortepiano, a lute piano, and a harpsichord. And then you can, of course, hear which instrument is playing. You have three different sounds.
I've never heard it done that way.
I hope it will be done very soon.
I can see that the history of the pianoforte is far more complicated and interesting than one might think.
Yes.
There are many, many different kinds. Our guest has been Eva Badura-Skoda. Thank you for guiding us through the world of the piano.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Year.
And just for a change of pace, this is Paul Badura-Skoda playing that Georg Haske circa 1818 fortepiano, the same one we heard the Mozart on earlier, with something here that's a little more modern. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as a guest from the Moscow Arts Theater tells us about the career and the plays of Anton Chekhov, a playwright not always understood in his own time or in ours. That's next Sunday here on Wisconsin Public Radio.